America is the incarceration capital, not just of the world today, but in fact in history. I don't know if a lot of Americans are aware of that, but in fact there's a statistic I put in the book which essentially says that the rate of incarceration is greater than at the height of the slave trade here in the US. Between 2.2 and 2.3 million people today are incarcerated in the US.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, making a killing off killing. The new minority group in the United States, those not in prison. And quotable Trump, all coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm your host. We're going to be taking a little break from religion and talking about a different issue altogether. We're going to be talking about a book called Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. One of the primary focuses of this interview is going to be on the United States prison system. And this is just one section in the book, but I think it's a very important humanist issue, and I think it's something that deserves our full attention. So let's get the author on the line. His name is Anthony Lowenstein. And I have the wonderful pleasure of speaking with Mr. Anthony Lowenstein. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on the Humanist Hour.
My pleasure.
You are here to talk about your book, or you are here for us to talk about your book, called Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Can you start by giving us a little synopsis of this book?
I can. So the title sounds a bit depressing, but I don't want listeners to think that it's all doom and gloom. Essentially, the book has been a work over 5 years. Oh. I've been to countries such as Afghanistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, here in the US, the UK, Greece, and my country, Australia, looking at people who make money from misery. Now, this can be through immigration, this could be through war, this could be through aid and development, this could be through mining. So what I'm looking at is the connections that I investigate and believe exist between, for example, here in the US, the reality of privatized immigration in the prison system, and I know we'll get to that a bit later, who's making money from that, why they're making money from that, and why that's a problem, both for democracy and accountability. And the idea, I suppose, is to almost connect the dots. I think many of us, and I'm a journalist and I've been a freelance journalist now for over 10 years, but I think for many of us in the public, issues and news seem to come and go very fast. So we see an issue we care about. It might appear in the press today, disappears tomorrow, usually. There are exceptions, but mostly it does. And I think too often we're not really able to join the dots to say, okay, why is there an economic system that is existing? Is there a political system that exists that is almost designed to exploit people? And many of us will feel that, yes, that is the case. We either see images on TV or we're upset when we see pictures from Afghanistan or Syria or whatever it may be. But often we're not really sure necessarily why that's happening or the economic interests that are behind. In other words, a war, for example, is not just groups fighting. It is people almost unavoidably making money from that situation, which is a grim reality. So to me, it was an investigation of both the economic reality, but also telling the stories of locals in various countries around the world, including here in the US, who are resisting that system.
All right, so I wanted to start by talking about the section in your book titled The United States, The Land of the Free Has Become a Country of Prisons. And my first question is, do we really incarcerate more people per capita than any other country?
In a word, yes. In fact, America is the incarceration capital, not just of the world today, but in fact in history. I don't know if a lot of Americans are aware of that, but in fact there's a statistic I put in the book, which I must admit I got from a New Yorker article a few years ago, which essentially says that the rate of incarceration, both people in prison and jail today, as well as some kind of correctional situation, so they might be out of prison, but they might be on parole, is greater than at the height of the slave trade here in the US. It's greater than during the worst days under Stalin in the former Soviet Union. In other words, the rate of incarceration in the US is so high and so racially based, and of course disproportionately affects African Americans and Latinos. And there are, no one knows the exact number, but between 2.2 and 2.3 million people today are incarcerated in the US. Around 6 million altogether have some form of correctional association, either have been in prison, as I said, under parole, they might wear an electronic tag for some perceived crime, and so many of those people are in prison for minor non-violent drug crimes. So yes, they may have dealt in cocaine, they may have been dealing in crack, they may have done things that are, yes, technically illegal to be sure, but they disproportionately affect those who are poor, African American, etc. And the reason that's a problem, apart from the obvious human rights question, is the fact that a lot of companies are making a hell of a lot of money from incarcerating those people.
So you're talking about privatized prisons, right?
Indeed.
Wow. And is this a fairly new phenomenon?
It's been going on for quite a few decades. It really started during the Reagan years, where the company that's the largest now in the US, it's called CCA, started during the Reagan years in the 1980s, hugely grown since then. And in some ways, it hasn't really mattered who's in power in the White House. Some of us on the left or those on the right will think that, well, when their president, so to speak, is in power, things might get better. Actually, it's made virtually no difference. There's been obviously slight changes, whether it's Clinton or Bush, for example, or Obama or Bush. Of course, there are differences, but overall, the number of those incarcerated has continued to go up. During the Obama years, the number has gone down a little bit. Obama, as president, has certainly done some minor reform to incarceration rates, but overall it stayed ridiculously high. And as I said, apart from the fact that it ruins millions of people's lives, essentially what it does in an age of mass incarceration, and in fact there was it's a wonderful book that I quote in my book by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow, where she essentially talks about how in the US in the last 30 years there's been a culture that has developed of guaranteeing that an African-American underclass will remain such, that there is a design policy coming out of Washington, and this obviously affects private corporations as well, prison corporations and the companies that make money from them, to make sure that an African-American underclass remains that way. And that is not just, as I said, disastrous for whole communities, but it breeds profound resentment amongst that community as well.
And I remember reading something in your book. It was a very interesting observation that politicians don't want to be seen as being soft on crime.
That's really true, and sadly that's not unique to the US. You know, I'm coming from Australia, one knows that's the case in the UK, in Britain, that somehow we have developed a tabloid media culture here, and often I think also in the so-called more sophisticated press, that politicians fear being seen as soft on drug users, or fear being seen as soft on drug pushers, or I guess in the current refugee issue around the world, soft on people smugglers. But the truth of the matter is that America has locked up so many people. The rate of drug use has actually soared. It's gone up. It hasn't gone down. The rate of drug crime has gone up. The rate of gun violence, for example, connected to drug crime has only gone up. One only has to look at the, really as an outsider for me, the insane rate of gun violence here in the US and the seeming inability, unwillingness to actually do anything concrete to try to reduce that. As an outsider, and I think as many non-Americans, and I know many Americans feel this way as well, it is almost a definition of madness. I mean, it is to us pretty crazy, but the reality, I suppose, is that the US has created a culture of mass incarceration where politicians, not just for fear of upsetting journalists or the tabloid press, but also the campaign finance situation in your country here guarantees that private prison corporations and private immigration corporations lobby legally. I'm not saying it's illegal, but politicians are able to receive huge donations from these corporations, almost guaranteeing that those policies will be very friendly to those corporations.
Okay. I was going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you about the connection, because we talked about one of the problems is this privatization of these prisons. So I was trying to see the connection where that actually leads to more incarceration. But now I see the connection. It's because of
It's money.
Yeah, they're basically money. Follow the money. Right, exactly.
I think it's also interesting. I think a lot of outsiders, non-Americans, view the American political system as corrupt. And there is a corruption of sorts. I mean, obviously, there is corruption in every political system. But in some ways, the problem here in the U.S. is that a lot of this is legal, that a politician is very able to receive money from pretty much any number of organizations or individuals, above board, legal. There is obviously illegal corruption going on too. But the problem is, for example, let me give you a couple of concrete examples. There are many states here in the US that have signed deals with private prison corporations to guarantee a minimum number of beds will be filled every night. And if there are less beds filled every night, the state pays the corporation, the private prison corporation, a fine. I mean, that's the insane situation. So 90% occupancy, 100% occupancy. Obviously, the state, the legal system has an incentive to make sure that more and more people are being sent to prison. The fact that it has zero effect on reducing crime or reducing drug use or drug trade is seemingly almost irrelevant. And we'll get to it a little bit later if we could. There has been a slight shift in the last few years, both with Republicans and Democrats here in the US, a realization that a culture of mass incarceration just doesn't work on a financial sense, on a social sense, on a political sense. But for three decades, roughly, since the 80s, this has been the reality, and money has been a massive factor in that.
I was going to ask you if this was a partisan issue.
It's interesting, you know, yes and no. The image, I think, is the Republicans are tougher on crime, or that's the impression. But actually, the record shows that, for example, Bill Clinton was him when he was president, and he's actually since apologized, since leaving office, put in place legislation that was disproportionately affecting African Americans and Latinos and imprisoning them for nonviolent drug offenses. This is a Democrat president. Certainly the rate of, for example, immigrants that have been kicked out of the US during the Obama years, again, a Democrat president, has been unprecedented, much higher, in fact, than during the George W. Bush years. So is it partisan? Yes and no. One can't, on the one hand, generalize. There are certain states where it's far more friendly to Democrats and Republicans, but certainly from a federal perspective and a presidential perspective, I would say that both major sides of politics here are being pretty awful. There's been one interesting exception recently. Bernie Sanders, who listeners will know, is running for president. I have no personal connection to him. I don't know him personally, just to clarify that. But he's put forward a legislation recently saying that all prisons in the US should not be privatized and they should be put back in public hands. It's an interesting idea. On the one hand, it's logical and makes sense, and he's not saying, and nor do I in the book, that suddenly putting prisons in public hands makes them good.
Welcome back to The Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm speaking with Anthony Lowenstein, author of the book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe.
The issue is the culture of mass incarceration rather than where people actually are being incarcerated. But the profit motive, as I talk about in the book and really go into detail, visiting various prisons and detention centers here around the US, shows private corporations have no incentive to provide better health care, better food, better really conditions, better medical care, better mental health care within incarceration, because for them, of course, that means that the bottom line will be affected. Guards are not given appropriate training. All these issues are a real problem when a private corporation manages the most vulnerable in our society.
Okay. Yeah, I guess any business or organization usually goes by a set of metrics, like how do you rate your business? How do you rate how well you're doing, the organization is doing? And yes, I would think in that case, for privatized prison, it's basically, like you said very clearly, it's an economic issue. It's how much money are we making versus how much are we spending, and what's the overall bottom line? Whereas maybe can we say the assumption with a public organization, like a government or state-run organization, it's not only about making money, but it's also about things like rehabilitation and education and recidivism rates. And there's probably many other metrics that they would go by. So is that a fair analysis of what's going on?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And again, let me just clarify that I'm not suggesting that, and I talk about this in the book, that a publicly run prison is by definition good, or that there's wonderful education in there or wonderful reform policies. Sometimes there are, sometimes they're not. I mean, the issue ultimately beyond the private public question in the US is a culture of mass incarceration, that the so-called solution to America's ills is to lock millions of people up. I mean, that is a solution that has been put forward by successive presidents here for decades. And when I think the US routinely criticizes incarceration in other countries, China, Iran, and elsewhere, yes, let's be critical of how Iran and China, for example, routinely abuses human rights, but let's also look closer to home. I mean, America's rate of incarceration leaves China and Iran far, far, far behind by a mile, by a mile. And that, I think, really goes to the heart of how we as a Western society want to view the most vulnerable people. To me, and I really posit these questions in the book, how do we want as societies to view dealing with the most vulnerable people? Do we see them as numbers to be processed? Do we see them as numbers to be profited from? Or do we see them as people who need to be taken care of, who need to be cared for, who need to be given mental health care? I mean, the issue, for example, has just come up again recently of another mass shooting in the US. Yes, reducing access to guns is a key question for you in the US, but also mental health care. I mean, the access to mental health is a key issue. And increasingly, both Democrats and Republicans believe, as indeed in my country, Australia, and in the UK, that privatizing that mental health care system is a solution to the problem. And I would argue it's fundamentally not. It's the opposite, in fact, that unless you publicly fund the most vulnerable people, the profit motive almost by definition will mean that so many people will not get the care that they need.
And why is that? Do you think like a private healthcare facility would be more focused on numbers as opposed to the overall outcome?
Often. I mean, look, there are many wonderful private healthcare centers in the US, to be sure, as there are in my country as well. Absolutely, there are some wonderful centers. But the issue, I think, when it comes, for example, to prison or immigration, and I've looked at this extensively in the book, is that there's too often cases where mental health providers simply don't see any incentive in going into prisons. Like, what are they gaining? They might gain, yes, a financial reward, possibly from a contract, but ultimately it's guaranteed that mental health care takes time. This is not going to get resolved in one session or two sessions, potentially. It might take years or months. And I think often what you find is that in states where there's a difference between a public or private healthcare system, or for that matter, public or private prison system, the public system routinely takes the prisoners or the inmates who are the least problematic, who need the least amount of care. So that almost makes a financial sense. And I think often in America, this debate is too often ignored. I mean, it's been interesting watching the discussion here in the US about prison reform, and President Obama this year has visited for the first time ever as a sitting president a federal penitentiary, talking about why there needs to be reform. All really, really important issues. However, what is routinely ignored, not always, but often in this debate, is the private prison and private immigration question. You can't talk about prison reform or immigration reform without talking about the profit motive. I mean, you just can't. And I think too often there is a somehow belief that if you simply put forward legislation in Congress to lessen the numbers of people who are being incarcerated or held in immigration detention, the profit motive will decrease. I mean, if you look at the annual reports, so interesting, of the major private corporations, CCA and Geo Group, they're the two large ones in the US, they fear immigration and prison reform because for them, that means there could be less beds to fill and therefore less profit. That's the reality. Now, some might say that's capitalism, that's what it is. Yes, that's true. But again, do we want, as a society, companies like that managing the most vulnerable people? And I would say that we don't.
Okay. So can you explain to me private immigration. I'm not sure exactly what that is.
Private immigration really is that the US obviously imprisons many, many immigrants who are coming mostly, as we know, from the South, from South America and Latin America. Mm-hmm. And many of the detention centers that these people are being held in are run by private corporations, essentially, and often the same corporations that are running the prisons. CCA is the largest in the country. And so I visited one of those centers in Georgia last year, near Atlanta. 3 hours from Atlanta. It was at the time the largest immigration detention center in the country. It housed about 2,000 inmates. And they were mostly, as I said, from Latin America. There was some from Africa and elsewhere, but mostly it was from South and Latin America. And again, the reason this is a problem is that, like with prisons, that the care that is given both to guards and inmates is pretty awful. And there are countless examples around the US where inmates, privately almost owned immigrants, are not given the care that they need. They're not given the medication they need. They're given awful food. There are cases where water is contaminated. Now, this can happen in publicly run facilities. Of course it can. But too often in the privately run facilities, the conditions are far worse. And that, to me, again, is a real problem for accountability and also for human rights.
Would you say that government facilities, public facilities, have greater oversight so things like this wouldn't happen?
In theory, yes. And again, as I talk about in the book, there are clearly many examples where publicly run facilities, prisons, detention centers for immigrants are often woefully managed, to be sure. In theory, there's more accountability, and there's many examples where that does happen. But the problem, I think, often is that in private centers, the issues are far worse, because when something goes wrong, the government blames the private corporation, the private corporation blames the government. I see this time and time and time again. And more importantly, there's much more difficulty in bringing justice to the people who are actually to blame, either before a court of law or before Congress. And I see this both in the US, in Australia, in the parliamentary system we have there, in Britain as well. Governments often like outsourcing prisons and detention centers to private corporations, because for them, it's one less level of accountability. Something goes wrong, they blame the company. You know, yeah. That happens time and time again. And I think what's happened over 30 years here in the US is that as more and more and more immigrants are incarcerated every night, and let's not forget that during the Obama years, since 2009 when he came into office, there has been massive increase in numbers of families, women and children who are being incarcerated nightly here in the US by authorities every night. Now, obviously, there's been also a surge in immigrants who are coming from Latin and South America because of various problems in those parts of the world. But the rate of incarceration for immigrants has hugely increased. And the Obama administration has outsourced more and more of these centers to corporations that they know don't work well. This is the crazy thing about this system. Then government reports themselves issue, you know, long detailed information about the corporations not operating well in immigration detention. But it has zero effect in these companies not getting more contracts. That, to me, is the system failing miserably. You fail and you keep on getting rewarded for that failure. It's crazy.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, when it comes to immigrants, we have to remember,
they're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Thank you, Donald Trump. Absolutely. And that mentality, you know, is really, it's been interesting watching, without wishing to go into too much detail about your presidential campaign, but that sentiment that Donald Trump expressed is obviously shared by, I would say, a vocal, sizable minority of Americans, and for that matter, a vocal, sizable people in my country, Australia, as well. That the sense somehow that the people that are being incarcerated, the people who are crossing the border, the people who are coming by plane, the people who the US are locking up, are somehow bad people. And yes, of course, there are rapists and murderers and bad people who are crossing the borders and are in jail. Obviously, not everybody is an angel. That goes without saying. But one of the things that's become so clear for example, in the current refugee crisis in Europe. And this is something that is so skewed in the debate here in the US, is the vast, vast majority of people who are coming from Middle East, from Africa, are educated, are trained, are willing to work, are keen to contribute to society. In fact, in the communities, in the societies where many of these individuals and families end up living, and this has been based on studies over the last decade or so, the communities benefit. They benefit, but the fear that exists of outsiders, of Muslims, of, you know, brown-skinned people, and let's face it, this is really about race and colour when it comes down to it. This right. is a fear often of white Americans and white Australians and white Britons and white Europeans, of somehow their established Christian culture being overrun by Islam, by the other. That I think runs incredibly deep in all these countries, is that somehow we are not gaining by a more multicultural mix. Now, from my perspective, and some listeners might disagree, but from my perspective, that makes our societies far better. But the problem is that CCA and Geo Group and G4S and Serco, they're both British multinationals, those last two, are willing and very able to gain from the fear that is both existing in the wider community towards refugees, and also willing to be very close to both sides of politics in whatever country they are, to be able to exploit that fear. And that exploitation means building more immigration detention centres and training their staff very badly and almost guaranteeing abuses within those centres. That, to me, is what the racial vilification of refugees leads to when it comes to economics and politics. In other words, the politics of fear that Donald Trump expresses, and let's face it, Donald Trump's plan, as I'm sure listeners will know, is that if he wins office, he will try to deport as soon as possible roughly 11 million immigrants. Now, what is not talked about, apart from the impracticability of actually doing that, is where are those people going to be housed before they're deported? They're going to be housed in privatized immigration detention centers. And you can be rest assured that many of the major corporations, CCA and Geo Group, would love a Donald Trump presidency. That's the reality.
Yeah, I bet. And Trump probably owns a few.
He's probably got shares in them. I don't know that, but you can be sure he probably does. Absolutely, yeah.
Right. All right, one more question I wanted to ask you about this issue. I read this somewhere where there were judges that were actually paid to send children or young kids to correction facilities. Did you write about that at all in your book, or you know anything about that?
Yes. I mean, there's certainly a number of states where that has happened, where a judge, as you say, is on the take, essentially, is getting paid by a corporation to make sure that they get long sentences. Yes, for sure. That does happen. It's pretty rare as far as we know, but that corruption is blatant and ugly and bad. But in fact, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, Bo, the real corruption in some ways is worse, that you have an ability to legally donate money or contribute money from private prison corporations to congressmen or women to almost guarantee the same outcome. Like, that's legal. That to me is the crisis. And as I've talked about to many people in the press and in the book as well, and this obviously far from the first person who's talked about this, the issue really here is the fact that money has corrupted the system, that if you even try to remove some of the campaign finance contributions in the US, you would radically change the system. And there's not really, from what I can tell, and I discuss this in the book, any serious push by Democrats or Republicans, because let's face it, whoever wins the presidency next year, whether it's Hillary or Trump or somebody else, they will have got there because of super PACs. They will have got there because of billions of dollars of money donated by various corporations who are going to want to get payoff when their candidate wins. That, to me, is the key problem with American politics. It's money. And I think when we actually look at the examples, whether it's private prisons or immigration or the arms industry, that is where I think reform could happen. But at the moment, apart from someone like a Bernie Sanders, in the mainstream at least, this is not really being talked about in a serious way, sadly.
So basically, we're not really looking at the exceptions or the outliers in the system, like that judge that you read about every so often doing something terrible and corrupt. The real problem has to do with the system itself.
Absolutely. And I think it's too easy to say those judges are the exception. They're the bad apples, and if we remove them, the problem is solved.
Right.
You're absolutely right. That's not the problem. I mean, yes, they're a problem, but it's far greater a problem where you have many states. I mean, this one quick example. Listeners will remember a few years ago there were very harsh anti-immigration laws in Arizona, which exist to this day. And the drafting of that legislation was obviously done by congressmen and women in that state, but it was also done with the massive influence, as I investigate in the book, by private immigration corporations that will benefit from locking up those immigrants. Like, that's a key part of that conversation that doesn't get talked about so much, that donations and input and involvement of private immigration corporations who will house those immigrants were central to making that legislation happen. That, to me, is a connection that needs to be made because, yet again, money speaks.
Okay. So what's the solution here, Anthony?
Well, solutions are possible. I think one of the first ways that we can at least try to reform a system or talk about that is actually acknowledging the fact that there is a problem. Now, that may be obvious to say, but I don't really see in the US a great deal of acknowledgement in the mainstream press and the political system of that actually being a problem. As I said before, we are talking in the US now about private prison reform. We're talking about immigration reform. We're not talking about the corporations that are benefiting from incarceration. That is a key point. We were talking, for example, before about the lobbying system of how these organizations are able to lobby. To me, real reform is actually banning corporations like that being able to donate money. And, of course, that goes against the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So is that likely to happen tomorrow? No. Is there momentum towards that happening? To some extent in certain parts of the left, but not in a way that actually is viable at the moment. So to me, reducing the ability for corporations to donate money to their congressmen and women.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm speaking with Anthony Lowenstein, author of the book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe.
I think there's also needs to be a change in conversation about the fact that locking up immigrants somehow solves a problem, that it's a deterrent. Locking up nonviolent drug abusers or dealers is a deterrent. It's not. And as I said at the beginning, there is a realization to an extent that mass incarceration is not working. That to me is arguably, I think, one of the great challenges facing America really today, where you have such a mass incarceration culture. Can we actually get to the stage here in the US, and for that matter in my country, Australia, where incarceration is not as high, but it's still very, very high, and the UK and parts of Europe, where it's in parts of Europe at least quite high, other parts less so, that you actually don't believe that solving your problems can be done by locking people up. And the evidence is it doesn't work, but it benefits the corporation who's making money from it. We're still a long way away from actually really grappling with that reality in the last 30 years.
Whew, heavy topic.
I know, heavy topic. God, I should have cracked some more jokes. I know, I apologize.
Well, let's get into something lighter, like disasters making a killing out of catastrophe in, let's say, Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Look, yes, I spent time in the last years in both those countries. I was in Afghanistan twice. The most recent time was this year. And I was interested in looking at how the US and other Western countries who invaded the country, as we know, after 9/11, they invaded in October 2001. They've been occupying the country, Afghanistan, since. And I would argue they're occupying Pakistan too, although in a different way. That there are countless corporations making a fortune from that war, not just from private security, but everything from the people who do the laundry, who provide the food, who do a lot of the janitor work. This has become a huge, huge industry. And the reason this is a problem, although maybe it's self-evident, is that it really, in a war zone context, almost guarantees no accountability. So, for example, during the Bush years after 9/11 and during the Obama years since, what many listeners might not be aware of, and journalist Jeremy Scahill, who's wrote a book called Dirty Wars a few years ago, goes into some detail about this. Many of the Obama counterterrorism plans in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere are run by private corporations. Edward Snowden, the last few years, the former NSA whistleblower, a lot of his documents show this as well, that a lot of the contractors the NSA employs are private corporations. The reason this is a problem, and maybe it's self-evident, but let me briefly explain it. The reason it's a massive problem is that do we feel comfortable as a society outsourcing the most deadly weapons, the most deadly policies to corporations with no accountability? I mean, essentially in Afghanistan, you have US-backed and US-trained assassination squads. I'm not using that term lightly. I'm talking about going around, knocking off, kidnapping, taking in people the US claims are Taliban or terrorists or insurgents. And the reality on the ground in these countries, as I have seen myself, is that this breeds an insurgency, it breeds a hatred of the US, it breeds a hatred of the West, which by definition breeds terrorism against the West. And I think until we actually really grapple with the fact that the US has made a conscious decision post 9/11, Bush years and Obama years, to outsource so much of its wars to the private sector, we really don't recognize the toll that it's taking on local communities in those countries, let alone in the wider world.
All right, well, let's move on to Greece. What's going on in Greece?
So a lot of listeners will be aware that Greece has had economic problems for a long time, that the economic crisis, financial crash in 2008 caused a huge schism around the world, and Greece was massively affected. Huge austerity was imposed by the European Union on Greece. The effect was that Greece, as a Western democratic developed nation, really went into a huge decline. And I spent time in Greece last year because I thought it was and is a tragic case study in how not to manage economic crisis. You have a situation where millions, and the country is about 11 million population, you have countless people who are living below the poverty line, you have a healthcare system which has collapsed, you have people often who are literally starving, you have children who are begging, you have an HIV rate which has hugely gone up because the healthcare to help people with HIV has decreased. You have a massive rise in the far right. Greece has, as its third major party in the Greek parliament, neo-Nazis, the Golden Dawn, which is the name of the party. And the reason this to me was important to examine under the guise of disaster capitalism was that the policies and the so-called solutions that are being suggested by the European Union, the International Monetary Fund and others, is to privatize the lot. In other words, you privatize the rail system and the healthcare system and all other systems, and somehow magically you're going to get a better outcome for the people of Greece. And that hasn't happened. The people are really suffering there. And the solution that is so-called solution that's being imposed on Greece is relevant to here in the US as well, because actually it says that austerity, so-called austerity and privatization, which is the given answer, doesn't actually work and only benefits the few corporations actually that are making money from it. And I think I wanted more people outside Greece and outside Europe to realize the really awful social and political effects on the people of Greece. And it's almost like a warning, Bo, because in a Greek democratic environment, to have a neo-Nazi party as the third major party in the country, if that's not a warning to the world, I don't know what is. I don't really know what else could be. And in fact, across Europe now, in many countries that are democratic nations, neo-Nazi parties, far-right parties who are profoundly anti-immigrant, of course, but also profoundly racist, are surging in support. And I think if we don't listen to the reasons why that's happening, then we're going to be deaf and blind for a very long time. It's worrying, very worrying.
And you spent some time in Haiti as well.
I did. Look, Haiti obviously is a very close U.S. neighbor. It's the poorest country in the hemisphere. And listeners may be aware that in 2010, there was an earthquake that struck in January, and it killed anywhere between 100,000 and 300,000 people. The reason this was important for me to cover was that I wanted readers to think about where their aid money goes. An event like that happens, and the American Red Cross or other organizations put out messages saying, give us money to help the poor people of Haiti. And I mentioned the American Red Cross because, A, it's one of the largest such groups here in the US, and it's emerged this year that they receive billions of dollars of US support. In other words, you and maybe other people gave money to a relief fund. The vast majority of that money did not go to the Haitian people. When the American Red Cross actually was asking for money in 2010, they literally had a handful of people in the country on the ground. That was never acknowledged, of course, in the press that they were doing. And the reason this was important to me and ties into disaster capitalism was that you had countless corporations, American and others, making a fortune from that disaster. Everything from building shoddy houses to building dodgy schools to providing shelters that were contaminated with bad chemicals. And the issue to me there is that, and I talk about this in other countries as well, that I think we often have a sense that non-government organizations, NGOs, are inherently good. They go into a country like Haiti and they do good work. They are designed to help people. They are not there for profit. The truth is that, in fact, many NGOs are there for profit. There are many NGOs doing wonderful work. I'm not disparaging the entire NGO community, far from it. But in places like Afghanistan and Haiti and Papua New Guinea, many of these NGOs actually are not doing good work because they're not training locals. They go into a country, they receive a contract to do work, and the system is set up in such a way that it's an inability to actually, or unwillingness to empower locals. So when those corporations leave, which they inevitably will, what is left? Not very much. And that to me is a key problem. So I give a quote of a WikiLeaks cable from 2010 when the then US ambassador in Haiti writes a memo to obviously the US diplomatic community, but aimed at the US business community, saying, quote, "There's a gold rush here in Haiti." And what he means by that is pretty clear. It means that there's a way to make a hell of a lot of money. And that, to me, pretty much goes to the heart of what disaster capitalism is and should not be, is that if you see a disaster happening and your first instinct is to go and make money from it, then apart from the fact that your moral compass is pretty off, right, it also says that the system is set up in such a way that actually is possible. And I'm trying to highlight that and make, I guess, readers more aware to ask, I guess, more questions, you know, about if they actually give money to an aid organization, try to find out where it goes. Do a bit of Googling about where has that organization give money in the past? Has it gone to the right people? As much as you can find out, do a bit of Googling. It's worth it.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. If we do give money to American Red Cross, for example, for the Haiti earthquake back in 2010, are you saying that the American Red Cross would then hire private contractors who may or may not make a profit to provide this relief? So it's not the Red Cross that's doing it directly, but they hire contractors to do it?
It's both. So what the American Red Cross did in that particular case, and there were questions for quite a few years about the effectiveness of what the American Red Cross were claiming. They, for example, claimed in the 5.5 years since, we built these schools, we built these hospitals, we provided X number of shelters for X number of Haitians. The truth is, there was a massive report that came out this year by ProPublica and Frontline on PBS looking into these allegations and saying, what did the American Red Cross actually do on the ground there? What actually were they achieving, if anything? And the truth is that the facts on the ground were pretty ugly, that they provided – there was very little evidence to show that actually these shelters were provided, that the schools were provided, that the homes were built. The Red Cross claimed to have built thousands of homes. And I've been to Haiti twice in the last year, so I wasn't looking at the Red Cross particularly, but other organizations. And the claims that organizations make versus the reality are very, very different, unsurprisingly. I guess what I'm saying here with the Red Cross and others are that they don't just claim to be outsourcing to contractors. That's what they're doing. So the problem with the massive aid industry is that so much of the money that, for example, you might be giving to the Red Cross stays here in the US, because US contractors are the ones who are going from the US to Haiti. Now, I'm not saying that a US contractor shouldn't get work, but what I'm saying is that very few Haitians get work. That the earthquake struck Haiti, and many Haitians themselves, and I met a lot of them, are pretty pissed off with the fact that they know that there are billions and billions of dollars sort of swishing around Haiti, and they see none of it. They get no training, no support, no backup, and they see often, and this is a cliche but it's true, massively overpaid US contractors coming into Haiti, doing work for 3 months or 6 months, and then turning around and coming back to the US. That's how the aid development industry works. It's an industry. And I'm not saying there aren't many, many very good people in the aid industry doing vitally important work. I've been living this year in South Sudan, which is a deeply troubled country, and there are some undeniably wonderful people there working under incredibly tough circumstances doing good work who are not there to make money. They're not earning much money anyway. But I'm saying in a lot of other contexts, the profit motive is a key component now of aid and development providing. And unless we actually realize that and understand that the money that many of us are giving to aid organizations goes towards contractors, then we're basically fumbling around in the dark.
Well, from a business perspective, I see something a little bit confusing here. If I were a contractor based in the United States and I got this contract from the American Red Cross to, let's say, build homes or make a development in Haiti, build schools, whatever, I would think that it would be financially advisable for me to hire Haitians at 1/100th of the cost that I would be paying American contractors to do the same work.
It's a good question, and that sometimes definitely happened. And again, there's definitely examples in Haiti where local builders and others were for sure hired. But there's a few issues there, Bo. The first one is that in many countries I studied, there's not literally the training or experience for locals to do the job. That's why there needs to be training. Like, you know, I've just been in South Sudan, for example, and the education there, as one example, is so bad. The war has been going on for so long. You literally have successive generations who have no education. So I'm not saying they probably can't assist in building a house, but there's no literacy. There's not the most basic things that you and I would just take as a given. And that can be a real problem in countries with very bad education or ongoing conflict or strife. There's also the fact that the contracting system in Haiti or Afghanistan, you are benefiting by subcontracting to other corporations that are Western, or you have a knowledge of that corporation doing that kind of work. In other words, there is almost like a a too cozy club that exists, you know what I'm saying, between these industries that, again, it's not a conspiracy, it's simply how it works. And I go into detail in the book about this, how these kind of organizations operate. That keep in mind the fact that the contracts that the American Red Cross or USAID, which is the main aid provider here from the US government, gives out, the contracts, Bo, are so huge. The money is so massive and the results often are so poor. But the key issue here is that the USAID is such a broken organization that actually contractors that are not delivering what they said they would, it has no effect on them getting more contracts. So in Haiti, for example, there are countless corporations that today are getting US taxpayer dollars to apparently build houses or do whatever they're claiming to do. They're not doing the work. They're not doing the work, but it's not stopping them getting more contracts. And this is the accountability deficit, which I discuss and examine in the book. That, to me, is a problem. So US taxpayer dollars is going to waste very, very often.
Wow. All right. Well, we got to wrap things up here. Before I let you go, Anthony, tell me how the film is coming along. I understand that you're making a film of this book.
I am. So I'm also, in the last year, been working on a film called Disaster Capitalism with a New York-based filmmaker called Thor Neurider. It's a work in progress. We've been shooting for about 4 years. And the aim of the film, I guess, is to both raise the awareness of people to these issues in their countries and also really ask the question, where is your aid money going? And the picture is pretty grim. So if people are interested in finding out more information about my work, about the film, they can just go to my website, which is just anthonylowenstein.com, where 90% of the film has been shot. We are now in the process of applying, as any filmmaker out there will know, post-production is a long and challenging process,
right,
basically to raise money to be able to do a rough cut of the film. We are in the process of raising money to do that. I'm not making a call for money, but if someone knows someone or is interested in supporting independent film, please get in touch. That'd be great. And we hope to finish the film realistically. I think it'll be next year now. And the aim is to really get into film festivals, of course, but also to the communities and the organizations that are involved in this world. So that involves the UN and NGOs and aid groups and universities and others who are actually on the front line on these questions. So the film is not based on the book. I guess you can say it's sort of an adaptation, or it's inspired by the book in a way, but it's a separate but related idea. And obviously films reach a different audience to a book. So yeah, it's an exciting prospect.
All right. Well, that sounds great. I really appreciate you taking the time, Anthony, and coming on and talking about this stuff. Very interesting.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I really do.
All right. You take care.
Thank you. You too.